topics and opinions expressed in the following show are solely those of the hosts and their guests and not those of W4CY Radio, its employees, or affiliates. We make no recommendations or endorsements for radio show programs, services, or products mentioned on air or on our web. No liability, explicit or implied, shall be extended to W4CY Radio or its employees or affiliates. Any questions or comments should be directed to those show hosts. Thank you for choosing W4CY Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Connected Table Live. We're your hosts, Melanie Young and David Ransom, your insatiably curious culinary couple. Each week we bring you the dynamic people who work front and center and behind the scenes in wine, food, spirits, and hospitality around the world. We love our life, we love traveling and sharing our discoveries with you, and we love sharing the people we meet with you as well. You're listening live on W4CY, and of course all our shows are podcast permanently to iHeart, Apple Podcasts, and about 30 other podcast platforms for your enjoyment anytime, anywhere you go. We've got a great show today. It's June 30th, so we're really into our summer reading.
It is full summer outside.
I'm doing like a book a week, David, right? Yeah. So we've got two great stories and authors on today who come from the journalism world from different perspectives. In our first segment, we're going to be speaking with Alexander Lobrano, known as Alec, who is a leading restaurant critic in France. He's an American in France, in Paris, reviewing restaurants, which is not easy. And he has a great new memoir out called My Place at the Table, A Recipe for a Delicious Life in Paris by HarperCollins. And in the second, we're going to talk to David Page, who is a well-known hit TV producer, most notably Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, and a major correspondent for Network News and producer, and he has a book out called Food Americana. So we're going to go from France to America. Perfect.
And it's a great way to kick off the 4th of July weekend.
Yeah, with our Lady Liberty in mind.
Yeah.
So first, let me introduce Alec Lobrano. So I love this lead. Alec Lobrano landed a job in the glamorous Paris office of Women's Wear Daily, but before that, he grew up in basically suburban Connecticut, and his main experience of French cuisine was the occasional supermarket eclair, okay? He was a shy kid, pursued a career in journalism, but really had to work hard at it. It is not an easy career. His wonderful, wonderful memoir, My Place at the Table, A Recipe for a Delicious Life in Paris, chronicles how he got to Paris and how he transitioned out of covering menswear for Women's Wear Daily and a stint in society to really pursuing what he loves, which is writing about food and restaurants, and how he did it, and also a little bit about his personal life. It's wonderful, and some of the anecdotes are great. So joining us from a small town in France, Alec Lobrano, welcome to the Connected Table Live.
Very much my pleasure to be with both of you.
Well, we're happy to have you join us today, Alec, and you are actually in the south of France right now, where we long to be. We try to get there every year or two, and we were there in 2019, actually right where you actually are located. Very nice to have you with the show. Why don't you get us started and tell us about how you grew up and what your interests were and how you got to where you are now?
I was as you mentioned, I was a very shy, I always had my nose in a book. But I grew up, my grandfather was the paternal grandfather is the fiction editor of The New Yorker. So I grew up in a very verbal, literary, bookish world. And my father had the idea, which was a good one, to send me on a traveling camp, which was a two-month trip that started in Wayne, Pennsylvania, and went all the way west to Utah, down through the southwest, Texas, into Mexico, as far south as Guatemala, and then back to Wayne, camping out every single night of the trip. This was sort of before anyone thought of Outward Bound. He had his own idea of Outward Bound. And it was a great idea. The only thing was is that instead of deciding that I wanted to play Frisbee with everybody else, I started filling little tiny diaries I started writing down everything I saw. And among the things I started writing down was everything I ate, because bursting out of the Northeast, which is a great food place, I'd never been much west of the Hudson. The food ways of America fascinated me. I mean, every single place we ended up in had some surprise, whether it was Czech knedly, Czech bread dumplings, different types of sausages, Mexican food. I mean, America is a groaning feast of a country. So I wrote all these things down. I took lots of pictures of what I ate. When I got home, my parents sort of looked at me, as though I'd come from the moon, and said, "So you went to the Grand Canyon and all you did was take pictures of cheeseburgers and chili." And I said, "Yeah, that's what I did." So this was kind of that trip was a huge success, because it was the incubus of what my life has been, which has been traveling to eat and then write about it. I find that the most intimate way for me, even today, I speak five languages: English, French, Italian, some Czech, the remnants of a bad love affair, and my favorite language, which is food. So, wherever I am, whether I speak the language, know anything about the country or not, the fastest and easiest and most delicious way to meet the place and the people is across a plate.
Yeah, the language of food, absolutely. And that can be a great culinary diplomacy as well, as we have reported on in the past. But, you worked in publishing for a time in New York. How did you transition from New York to Paris? Because everybody's dying to know that, because we all have that dream. And, of course, when you got there, you were really not writing about food for a living. You're writing about fashion. So tell us about that time.
Well, when I first moved to New York, finished college and moved to New York, I was working as an editorial assistant at Random House, and the editor for whom I worked, Joe Fox, who was Truman Capote's editor, and he was a brilliant, brilliant pencil editor, as they used to call them, also published a restaurant guidebook by a man named Seymour Bridgekey. Mm-hmm. Then the book was The Restaurants of New York. I'd never read restaurant criticism before, much less a restaurant guidebook, and Mr. Bridgekey was a witty, incisive, and insightful writer, because his portraits of the various New York City restaurants weren't just what was in the plate, but who else was in the restaurant, what the neighborhood was like. It sort of opened up the possibilities of restaurant writing to me. So I planted a seed. I continued working in book publishing. Then I worked at a variety of different magazines, lying there in my studio in Waverly Place every night, trying to figure out how I'd get back to Europe, having studied in London for a while. And finally, I ended up, during a brother of mine is a lawyer and was living in London, visited him and ended up talking to someone unbeknownst to me, who's the editor of one of the big newspapers in London, who offered me work on a freelance basis, retooling their Sunday supplements. So I moved first from New York back to London, where I'd already lived once. Which was great. I love London. But I was always peering across the channel, thinking, London's great. I've done this before. It's fascinating to be working for a British newspaper here. But what can I do to get, how am I going to make it that extra, the last 50 miles to get to France? Because that's where I'd always wanted to be.
And you've been there for over 30 years now, which is pretty impressive. David, what's interesting reading My Place at the Table, it really shows the amount of work it takes when you're a freelance writer to make those connections. And someone gave you some really good advice. They said, stop sending out letters and resumes and pitches. Get in front of people and meet them. Right, Alec?
Well, that's what you have to do. And I think even today, actually, Melody, that it's still face-to-face. And that's why, frankly, as we're living our pandemic years, I find Zoom to be kind of fascinating, because Zoom is an intermediate, way of doing that. I mean, you are actually interacting with another person through a screen like you do on FaceTime. So even now, I think that a real conversation where you can pick up all of the signals that we're constantly giving to each other, knowingly or unknowingly, when we're speaking, that's how these things work. My putting a resume and a letter into an envelope and dropping it in a mailbox did no good whatsoever. You know, you had to push. I was lucky in those days, though, because the publishing world was fertile and thriving. It's a completely different universe, as you both know today, mm-hmm. where we have one, you know, we're still, although I think actually we are now dominantly digital. I think we are now really living our verbal lives pretty much now online. I think we're seeing the end. I think that the pandemic is pushing this faster, pushing us away from paper faster and faster, maybe with the exception of books. But I think for magazines and newspapers, that the future is very much digital. And I think that it's more complicated to create a career as a journalist now than it was when I started, because the pay scales are different and, you know, the frequency is different. I mean, I had the luxury of, you know, deep feature writing assignments that actually were, you know, in terms of what I was being paid and the time I spent, were remunerative. I don't know how people do it today. I mean, it's much, much harder. And yet, on the other hand, the thing that's great is that there's a greater degree of openness and diversity than there was before. I think that media is more participatory in America than it's ever been before and more inclusive. And I find that's fantastic. But the life of a self-employed wordsmith is a pretty challenging thing. I mean, as my brother, my lawyer brother, always says, you're lucky because you get paid to do what you love. And that's true. I love to read, eat, meet new people, and travel. So, yes, that's true. But as I say to him, if you see me in a dark corner of Grand Central Station someday, I hope you'll buy me a sandwich.
So, Alan, you've written for some amazing outlets. I mean, all the ones that matter. Who are you currently contributing for or writing for now so that our listeners can look you up, in addition to your own wonderful website?
Well, thank you for that. I'm writing regularly for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. I write for The Guardian in the UK. Mm-hmm. I've just started working for the Financial Times. I contribute to most of the major food magazines, Bon Appetit, Saveur, which is now only online,
right.
And Food and Wine. And in terms of travel, Condé Nast Traveler, you know, I write for more people than I can actually even remember half the time.
It's amazing, and because it's a lot of work getting those assignments, so kudos to you. You know, and kudos for sticking your course. I personally was, you know, you were writing about menswear. You were not really happy. Then your editor wanted you to cover society. I had to smile when you talk about the Marie Elaine de Rothschild dinner with Nan Kepner eating two mushrooms, because I used to read and devour those outlets when I was a publicist. And I had to laugh at the high society and your recounts of Yves Saint Laurent dropping ashes everywhere with a footman behind him. And you were really disenchanted for that, and kudos to you for sticking to your own guns and saying, this is not what I want to do. I want to write about restaurants. That must have been a tough call, because you had to go from a nice salary to, oops, now what?
Well, that's exactly, you know, that was, I mean, that, and this is something too that I say sometimes to my nieces and my nephews, who seem to want a guarantee that everything is going to work out okay. And I say, you know, if I had followed that line of thought, I would never have the life that I have. I took a lot of chances. I mean, when I quit that job, my parents thought I'd lost my mind. You know, but I thought to myself, and I've always thought this way, whether it was, you know, ending up as an editor at Random House or working for Women's Wear Daily in Paris, if I did this once, I can always go back and find something similar. You know, once you've gotten to that place, you can revisit it most of the time. If I don't take the chance, and in this instance, what you mentioned, Melanie, was the fateful day when I had kind of locked horns with one of the editors. I mean, the office in Paris was a great place to work. There were a lot of incredibly intelligent people there. And it was, you know, it was a freewheeling place because as long as you got your work done, nobody really cared when you did it. I mean, you know, you knew what you had to do. If you came in and worked all day on a Sunday, you did that. If you stayed there until 3 o'clock in the morning, that was fine too. They sent somebody who was very much of a, you know, like a headmaster type who insisted that everybody punch the clock at 9 o'clock. It was a disaster. Mm. And that was kind of killing off the atmosphere and the fun of what we were doing. And then I had done a profile of the French equivalent of Barbara Walters, who Americans might know because she was the wife of Dominique Strauss-Kahn, her name of the whole, you know, scandal at the Sofitel in New York. And Sinclair, who's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant journalist and broadcaster. And it had been an interview that we negotiated for months to get. And I've been told she will give you 20 minutes and that's it. But we ended up talking for an hour and a half because in the middle of the whole thing, she said, you know, I'm actually enjoying this. And I have questions I want to ask you. And I said, well, you're welcome to ask anything you like. So it worked out well. I wrote what I thought was a really fascinating story of her, about her. And then the newly arrived headmaster type from New York had problems with it because it was not cookie cutter like. And he insisted that I go back to see her, which was really sort of pushing me up to the wall because there was no way that I was going to go back and see her. And so I took myself out for, I went for a long walk in Paris, went to one of my favorite restaurants, had a great lunch, went to an afternoon movie, went home, took a nap, called up and quit. You know, the idea being, okay, I have enough money probably to hold out for about 6 months and we'll just see how it goes, you know? And I've never looked back. I've been, you know, it's a mixture of really hard work, good luck, persistence, and a real passion for what I do that I think has made me, has made this work out for me.
It does take passion, right, David? We wonder, are we crazy for what we're doing? I was reading it, and I was like, oh, it sounds like us. And, you know, I loved it when John Fairchild called and wanted you to kill the L'Ami-Louis article because you found it to be, you know, everybody talks about L'Ami-Louis, and we have a giggle about it ourselves because we went and we're like, you're kidding. And you know,
I'm glad you did that.
So let's talk about, you know, I love the way you talk about some of the restaurants and the Americans, you know, read these guides, they read the top 10, they read the list, the listicles, and they just flock to those. And you always see the Americans there, but you really go out of your way to find the lesser known, independently owned, unique places, and you support them, even though you also go to the Michelin rated. How do you, you know, tell us about your philosophy on that and how you seek out these places and maybe share a few.
Well, you know, my point of view on restaurant reviewing is that I work for you. I mean, the reason I'm doing this is to make sure that you are provided with information that's going to enable you to decide whether or not that's a place that a restaurant that you'd actually like to go to, and hopefully not be disappointed if you end up there disappointed on the basis of what you read from me. I feel that, you know, even though I've lived in France for all these years, I'm very aware of the fact that for most people, you know, to have a week in Paris is an enormous luxury. And if you have a week in Paris, you don't want to have a bad meal. So I take it very seriously and very personally. And I think that I'm also very aware of the fact that, you know, Paris is a very expensive city. What I know is that you can eat extremely well in Paris without spending a lot of money. I also know that at this particular point in time, I would steer people away from the Michelin restaurants. I mean, I think that Michelin is a useful resource. It's been a trellis for French gastronomic culture for, you know, well over a century now. But the world has changed. And, you know, some of the best restaurants, the most interesting restaurants right now, like Septime, for example, which is one of my favorite restaurants in the 11th arrondissement, is a place that they still, you know, I mean, does it have a Michelin star? I think it may now, but it's, the chef doesn't care. I mean, it's a beautiful restaurant with utterly charming service that everybody wants to go to because It's like being invited to a party, and it's absolutely magnificent contemporary French cooking, the type of stuff where never in a million years would you think of making something like that or pairing those, these tastes together, these textures. That's the food that really interests me, and I think we're living right now, we're living a sort of a gastronomic interregnum in France because a lot of the long-standing Michelin-guided architecture of French gastronomy is shaking in the breeze. Alain Ducasse's Michelin three-star restaurant closes on June 30th. Wow. The Plaza Atiné decided to close it. They have not reopened they turned Les Ambassadeurs at the Hôtel de Crillon, which was a three-star restaurant for a long time, into a bar. These places, Le Grand Véfour has shifted from being a very stuffy two-star restaurant to a place that serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner for about 50 euros a piece. And now it's worth going to because it's the same chef. It's one of the most beautiful restaurants in the world. And if you sit outside in the Palais Royal, it's one of the most beautiful places in Paris. So things are changing really, really quickly in Paris right now. I think that these were things that were happening before the COVID plague, but I think COVID has really accelerated this evolution. And I think that we're waiting to see as Paris recovers and reopens. There's a spectacular crop of really, really talented young chefs in Paris, French, but also from all over the world. And I'm hoping that their restaurants are going to have made it through the rapids. One in particular I would like to note, and it's a restaurant called Mosuke, which is Mosuke. And the chef is a Franco-Malian. Mali's the country in West Africa, of course. His parents are Malian immigrants. He was born in France. He's French. He's a Frenchman of African origins who then fell in love with Japan because Mosuke, the name of his restaurant, Mosuke was an actual person. He was a Mozambican slave who became a samurai in Japan in the 17th century. He's the only black samurai. It's a fascinating story, and it tells everything about the chef, Mori Sacco, his food. It's a mixture of France and West Africa and Japan, and it's fascinating. And for me, it's a real exemplar of what's going on in Paris right now, where invisible boundaries are crumbling and creativity is jumping fences. And it's a really exciting time to be eating in Paris and everywhere in France for that matter.
Well, we think that the wave of immigration, although has been controversial, also in the United States, has created these amazing restaurants. We're seeing it. We're in New Orleans right now, where it's a huge melting pot based on Creole cuisine, but also the immigrants that came over generation after generation. And I think you're seeing that in France. I will say, and David and I will smile, we were happy to see in your little black book at the back of my place at the table, Josephine Chez Dumenay, which is one of our favorite little places to go when we get to
I think it is our favorite place to go. We go there literally every time we go to Paris.
Rue de Cher Schmidt.
Yeah, it's just a great spot.
We saw Princess Carolyn there, so that was David's big smile. I noticed he wasn't looking at me anymore. And he was looking up at the mirror, and that's because Princess Carolyn and at the time her husband.
He should have been looking at his beau bourguignon is what he should have been looking at.
Well, I wasn't. That and the foie gras stuffed morels, which is an amazing dish.
Unbelievable. Incredible. Yes.
Just the best dish I've ever had. Yeah. Anyway, that and the Joel Robuchon's foie gras and black bean sauce.
And Chez Le Mijan, which is a lovely little restaurant we've been to. There are a few of them in your little black book we've been to. And I'm going to say this, we haven't been to Paris in quite some time.
No, it's been a while.
Yeah.
You know, Alec, looking at your book, what's the one thing that you want people to take away from reading it?
Let's see. I think that I'd go back to what we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation. I mean, food is a language that we all speak. I would encourage, as I've done over and over and over again, when friends come to France, whether friends and family, the last time I had a couple of nieces who came here, I said, you're not going to eat chicken breast and pasta the whole time you're here. You're going to take some chances here. And if, you know, you've never eaten an oyster, you're going to have an oyster. I encourage people to come to speak the language of French food because it is, it's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful language. And it's a wonderful, wonderful way, prism through which to see this country. And my joy in having learned this country and this culture, you know, through its food, is just absolutely infinite. You know, I feel, I mean, the French, where I am now in this little village, when I go into the post office, which is wonderful because there's never anybody in there, and there's no line, and the lady has a big smile on her face, so it's quite different from big city post offices. She always looks up and she says, ah, bonjour, notre Américain. which is wonderful. It absolutely delights me every time because at once it demarks difference because notre Américain means our American. Mm-hmm. So at once I am part of the village, but my difference, the fact that I'm American, is noted. That's the way I position myself in life too. I love the United States. I did not decide to build this life in France because I don't like America. It's just that I am insatiably curious, whether it's food, travel, whatever. And, you know, once I realized when I was a kid in third grade in Connecticut that the map on the grade school wall was not accurate. In other words, the U.S. was in the middle of the map. after my first trip to Europe in 1972, I realized the United States was not the most convenient location from which to travel. And I thought, okay, well, I'll go out into the world and stay for a while. And that's exactly what I've done. So my book is really, it's a journey of gastronomic coming of age story, and also a journey of self-acceptance. The self-acceptance that comes from realizing that secrets are only powerful when they're secrets. You know, I mean, every life has its challenges and its disappointments, but if you put them out in broad daylight, they lose the power of shame. So that's part of my story, but most of it really is the swashbuckling adventures of a writer who absolutely loves food and who absolutely loves France.
Absolutely. And there are some very revealing moments in the book. It is a coming of age because it is a memoir. And I think it's really important to underscore that it's not a recounting of everything you eat. There is a deep dive into your childhood and the challenges you faced growing up and a fall, you know, you're coming to terms with your father, who is, you know, very handsome apparently, and your mother. And I have to say the exchange with your mother, when you first met Ruth Reichel and the other woman was, I have to say my mom was at the table. My mom would do something like that. Your mother was quite a character. And she reminded me very much of my mother
very
just suddenly
of,
taking over the table and saying
yes.
Stuff that isn't quite appropriate to what you really want. And I had to smile. That's
well, you know, Melody, I guess that would have to go into the category of poisoned gifts. Because if my mother had not been so difficult that day, I mean, Ruth, you know, that gave Ruth and me a reason really to bond because, as I think I say in the book, when I called her to thank her, you know, she had invited us, my mother and another friend to go out to lunch when she was working as a restaurant critic for the New York Times. And my mother behaved so badly that, you know, it was just, I have a huge hive in the middle of my head, like an Indian marriage dot. But when I called Ruth to thank her, she was laughing so hard she could barely even speak. I mean, she said, I've watching you try to feel that nonstop torture was one of the funniest things I have ever seen in my entire life.
It really was. And it actually drove me to reopen up Tender at the Bone and Comfort Me with Apples and rereading both of them because of that exchange. Because I just had to laugh about it, but it did bring you to Ruth, and you did have, until it was quickly shut down by Psy, you did have a great gig at Gourmet, which is one of the great losses in journalism. But the good news is, as you said, there's always new opportunities to express yourself in journalism. One last and brief question. Is there a topic that you've never covered that you would like to aspire to cover in your lifetime?
I'm fascinated by art and architecture. I've written a lot about the art and architecture of food. Mm-hmm. But my mother, who is a very serious lady, was a philosophy and art history major. So I grew up very much, you know, steeped in all of that. I'm fascinated by art and also by architecture and urbanism. And these are things, you know, if I write about food, it's not because I don't find other things interesting too. And I think that that's very important to mention, actually, because I think that anyone who's a one-strut writer, you know, someone who writes about cars or who writes about theater criticism or whatever, you can feel when the person is not broadly interested by the rest of the world. I hope that anyone who reads me understands that I'm an avid reader. I'm in passionately interested by politics. You know, I read nonstop, you know, history, fiction, everything. And, you know, I have a very broad field of interest and in which I situate food and from which I'm able to take references to better describe food, I hope.
Well, food is definitely a centerpiece for many, but it's a spoke in the great world of amazement out there. And like you, we are insatiably curious and look at everything we do from that perspective. Alec, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for joining us today on The Connected Table. Again, the book is My Place at the Table, A Recipe for a Delicious Life in Paris. And your website is aleclebrano.com, or did I just butcher that?
No, it's alexanderlebrano.com.
Alex, yeah. His full name, not Andy.
Alex. Oh, God.
That was funny. Alexanderlebrano.com. Thank you so much. We enjoy reading your work, and we'll continue to do so when we can get back to Paris ourselves in France. Thank you.
I hope that we get to meet up at Chez Dumenay sometime, and a happy 4th of July to you.
That would be fun, and to you as well.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
Okay. You're listening to The Connected Table Live with Melanie Young and David Ransom. We will be right back with our next guest, and we're going to talk food Americana. Stay tuned. Listening to The Connected Table Live with Melanie Young and David Ransom. We are waiting for our next guest to be connected, David Page. But while we're doing that, I'll tell you a little bit about him and his book to keep things moving. Okay. So David Page is a very successful television news producer. He's worked with CBS News. He's worked with ABC. He started the Today Show Weekend Edition. He's covered lots of pretty amazing stories, including walking through the Berlin Wall and whatnot. Many may not know this, but he also is the originator of the hit series Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, which you can find on Food Network. I don't know about you, but we're fans, right, David?
Yeah, we watch it on a fairly regular basis.
And we learned that it's kind of a very complicated show to produce, right, David?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not as easy as you would think. But what's really neat is that he's also written a book called Food Americana. And it is, if you are a food history buffer, of culture vulture of food, you're going to love this book. It basically takes you through some of the many dishes we know and love and tells amazing stories about them and like little backstories. And he interviews everybody from Alice Waters to old cowboys. I particularly liked some of the sections on sushi and Chinese food, and actually the Asian influence, which we're going to talk about when we're going to when we come back. And I'm just going to hop off right now to try to reach him, David. So why don't you tell everybody what we're doing in New Orleans?
Well, we, as many of our listeners may know, we've been on a very long extended road trip for the last 11 months or so after selling our house up in New York's Hudson Valley. And we hit the road and went back and forth. Unfortunately, one of the things we wanted to do was do this road trip through Europe. That was the original plan, but COVID had other ideas. So we actually hit the road on the east coast of the United States and started driving around and visiting the places that we had never gotten to see, due to the fact that a lot of times when we travel, it has been overseas. So we have been on the road along the east coast from Maine to Florida and then as far west as New Orleans, and all back and forth. And a lot of it was off the highway, so not traveling on the interstate and really taking back roads so we could really see what America had to offer. And it's been a lovely trip. And we are now currently in New Orleans again. This will be the second time during that road trip that we've come to New Orleans. And I think we're here for a little bit of time. Right, Melanie?
I hope so, because I'll be tired. My butt wants to stop. My body's hurting. I want to just stay put for a while. And besides that, this is like festival season. So we already have been to the Seafood Festival, and we're going to the Creole Tomato Festival. Oh, and so onward, we've got David Page on the show now. Hi, David.
Sorry.
I think we have him live.
No,
David Page?
There was a caller on the line, but he hung up.
Oh, okay. So we don't have him. So back to what I was going to say. We're getting ready to, I told David we're going to visit culinary festivals and food festivals, because Louisiana is the festival state. So we were at the Jean Lafitte Seafood Festival last week in Bayou Country, and we saw Rock and Goopsie. Ah, and then we're going to go to the Creole Festival this weekend. David Page, yes, we can hear you. Welcome to the Connected Table Live.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We did a little intro on you already about your amazing television career and how you were the originator of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. Tell everybody now what you're working on, because you've got some interesting things in production.
Well, I'm mostly working on a follow-up book.
Already?
Yeah, there was so much that couldn't go into the first book that I'm following more American food down its natural path, and I've got a second book in progress.
Well, that's pretty fast. So let's talk about the first book, Food Americana, which I thought was really fun because I'm a food culture vulture, and I love the different sections. I think one of my favorites was the sushi and the dumplings. But how did you go about coming up with the different sections?
That is one of the wonderful things about being an author. You can determine for yourself what you think is editorially relevant. And I did a fair amount of research into what Americans eat and what they sort of eat, as opposed to things that are popular in certain places but not others. And I decided that the items that I was going to feature were the ones that, for the most part, made up American cuisine. I mean, obviously, there are things like steak that I chose not to chase down, because basically that's lumped into beef as eaten in Europe. But I went for specific foods, most of which had a pretty clearly identifiable backstory as coming from someplace else.
A lot of it does, because we are an immigrant culture. Although some people say, David, what do you think the most American of foods is?
Lobster.
You said that? Okay. Lobster?
Yeah, because it's the one food that actually is physically indigenous to North America. Ruth Reichel said to me, you know, people talk about hot dogs or pizza being the ultimate American food. In her opinion, lobster is the ultimate American food. And I'm not going to disagree with her. Now, look, it still came to us, to American cuisine, from another culture. It came from the culture of the Native Americans in New England who taught the settlers how to eat this buggy looking thing by, at the time, wrapping it in seaweed and throwing it onto the coals, which is a cooking technique that is still pretty obvious today in New England clam bakes. But the lobster was here to be found when explorers and then settlers came here. It was not brought here by someone else. Also, I happen to love lobster, and I grew up in New England, so there.
Well, you know, you're living in Minnesota now, right?
No, that's... I haven't.
Are you moved? Where do you live now?
I am living on the Jersey Shore on Long Beach Island, a tourist island, which is the first sandbar north of Atlantic City. It's where we had a summer house forever. And when our daughter decided to go to college in New York City, we decided to sell the hobby farm in Minnesota and move to the Jersey Shore.
Well, LBI, as the locals call it, it's a great place.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I spent a year on the Jersey Shore living down towards Cape May. And the whole Jersey Shore is really a lovely area to be.
I'm curious.
As a hobby, I do a radio show once a week on a little community station down in Cape May, which is a great little town. But yeah, the Jersey Shore is fantastic. People, you know, people don't realize we have incredible food down here. Long Beach Island, LBI, as you correctly refer to it, has an active commercial fishing port at the north end. And we bring in my opinion, the finest scallops on the face of the earth. You go to dinner and you see the tourists eating fried shrimp from Indonesia. I kind of want to wake them up and go, hey, guys, we actually have local food. Come back in August when we're bringing in fresh tuna. But, hey, people are going to eat what they're going to eat.
You know, yeah. It's funny you should mention the scallops. When I was living down in near Cape May, one of my neighbors was a fisherman, and he actually went out and he was a scallop fisherman, and went out and brought in scallops. His name was Jimmy, and he'd hand me a bag at the end of just about every day and say, "Here you go, just for being the neighbor."
They're incredible.
Nothing like them.
The secret, though, people, it takes a while to learn this. You've got to thoroughly dry them before you cook them if you want to get that crusty interior.
Yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise, the liquid from inside them, in essence, steams them. They still taste as good, but you don't get that crunch.
David, I'm curious, when you were researching food Americana, was there a particular chapter where there was kind of like an aha, like I had no idea?
Yeah, I had no idea that lox and bagels were not a regularly consumed combination among my people, the Jews of Eastern Europe when they were in Eastern or Central Europe, but that it was in fact a combination created in the United States when the Transcontinental Railroad made it possible to ship salmon from Seattle to New York, but absent refrigeration, the salmon had to be packed in salt for safekeeping. And salt brine salmon is lox, as opposed to smoked salmon, which most people think of as lox, and it's all fine and dandy on a bagel. But the concept of putting lox, much less cream cheese, on a bagel was a complete, that combination happened here. The bagel itself came from Poland.
I didn't know the bagel came from Poland. I learned a lot reading the book. Some of it I knew and some of it I didn't. There's some great storytelling here. And along the way, you talk to people like Alice Waters, who, you know, it's kind of interesting. You're like, how did she get all involved with this? Talk to us about some of the people you met, characters that you met along the way that would be fun to share their stories.
Well, Alice Waters, who, my journalistic motto, having been an investigative guy, is call and ask. All they can say is no. And she was glad to talk about her role in the upscaling of pizza, which happened at Chez Panisse and was then copied by Wolfgang Puck and kind of exploded from there. I found her extremely interesting. Cecilia Chang was a remarkable person. She passed away shortly after I interviewed her. She was 100 when I did. Cecilia Chang is really... the most important figure in the development of Chinese food in the United States. She had a restaurant in San Francisco called The Mandarin. And I visited her at her incredibly tastefully appointed apartment in San Francisco. She opened the door. She was tastefully appointed in probably an $8 million gray sweater and black pants and looking incredibly vibrant, wearing pearls. And we sat in her living room and talked. And she actually went to the other room and brought out a manila envelope in which, well, I guess this is classy enough, I should call it an envelope, in which she, from which she extracted one of the original menus from the Mandarin, complete with ballpoint pen strike throughs and added words. And that was, on the one hand, as a historical relic, it was kind of chilling. On the other hand, boy, she was a dynamic woman to talk to. She was clearly, obviously someone special.
You're very lucky to have met her. Unfortunately, all the years I've worked in food, I knew of her, but did not get to meet her. And she really is incredible and a legend. And, you know, Asian food has become very popular as, you know, waves of immigrants have come here over time. And I think a lot of the popularization of certain kinds of foods have come thanks to the many wonderful people who bring their culture into this country, starting with, you know, West Africa to Latin America to the Eastern Europe migration to Asia. It's fascinating. I'm curious. I know you're working on another book. Do you see some other emerging foods or categories that you're diving into for your research?
Well, it's very, very hard to predict what Americans are going to want to eat. In this book, I made a distinction between what I call American cuisine, which is almost exclusively foods brought by immigrants that have been adopted so completely by Americans everywhere in the country that they are now part of our daily menu. There are other cuisines brought here from other countries that I don't think have yet or may ever achieve that kind of ubiquity, even though they are extremely popular in many places. I mean, Thai cuisine, on the one hand, is extremely popular, especially in major metropolitan areas, but is still not part, in my view, of a daily menu where when the average American is thinking through his or her choices, Thai doesn't necessarily pop up. I feel the same way about Vietnamese cuisine, the banh mi especially, which, again, is a very popular item in many places, but isn't necessarily something people would think of when thinking about that day's choices all across the country. Peruvian cuisine has, the advocates of Peruvian cuisine have been trying for years now to get Americans interested, and there is a fair presence of Peruvian cuisine in many places in America, and it is a wonderful cuisine, but it hasn't broken through, and I don't expect it to. What I do see, and certainly there will be a food from some country that I cannot predict that will break through. It is possible, I say, that we're finally going to give African cuisines, because Africa is a massive place and the cuisines of the different countries are extremely different. Africa is much bigger than Americans realize, thanks to Mercator projection. But it's possible that an African cuisine of some sort, probably West African because of the awful history of 400 some odd years of enslaved Africans being brought from that part of the continent. It's possible some kind of African cuisine will break through. What I do see happening is Americans broadening their palate to the point where they're now trying other variations, other regional variations of cuisines we've already adopted. I think the most prominent that I mentioned in the book is birria de res, that Mexican spicy beef stew that has, in the last few years, crossed the border from Tijuana and then hit Southern California and has now come all the way east to the East Coast. I'm unsure about its prevalence between the coasts, although people in a number of places have told me they're enjoying it. Something like Birria is having a moment. Will it stay? Will it become popular enough that you expect it on a menu next to tacos? I don't know.
Well, I think that's interesting. You never, just as long as it's not avocado. You know, my theory is once you see it at Dunkin' Donuts and Burger King, you're doomed. So we saw an avocado toast at Dunkin' Donuts. I'm like, oh my God, you know.
Well, hold on. Dunkin' Donuts.
I love Dunkin' Donuts.
They are the largest purveyor of bagels in America. And
you can still get
a decent bagel if you look for it in a lot of places. So it doesn't mean it's doomed. It does mean it's popular. And you know, popularity is a funny thing. We've had decades of lousy bagels nationally. But in the last few years, there has been a return in a number of places to the artisanal bagel.
Well,
I don't
know
how badly Dunkin' is going to be able to destroy avocado toast, but I'm sure after they're done melding it into something horrible that comes encased in plastic, someone somewhere will say, hey, what if I made my own sourdough and raised my own avocados? Could I do it better? I'd like to see that.
Well, it probably, you know, the good thing is we've got another wonderful, talented cooks and curious people out there in the profession who are always trying to elevate food. We have to bring this show to a close, so I just want to make sure that we have been talking with David Page. He was the originator of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. He's now put pen to paper and has published the book Food Americana, the remarkable people and incredible stories behind America's favorite dishes. This is a great book to kick off the 4th of July weekend. I kind of glided through it. I really had fun with it. And I know our listeners will as well. David Page, thank you for joining us on the Connected Table Live.
And thank you so much for those kind words and for having me.
Our pleasure. And, you know, we hope everybody picks up some books and reads. This is a time to get off the computer, get a good book, enjoy it wherever you are, and savor every page, because there's some wonderful food writing out there, as we have shown on today's show. You've been listening to The Connected Table Live. You can find us on your favorite podcast platform anytime, anywhere. Until our next show, stay insatiably curious. Thank you.